short ball, flapping loose back and full scarcely past square leg.
So this is cricket.
Victory to the Australians by 8 wickets.
Welcome to episode 6 of the Summer of Cricket with Straubs and Snew. We're back after the Christmas break. Bit of a terrible time to take a break with the flood of cricket coming through, but of course family commitments are still going to take precedence. It's a great welcome back to the show to my co-host Vishnu. Welcome back. Hope you had a lovely Christmas and a good new year.
Yeah, happy new year, Straubs, and to all our listeners, valued dear listeners. Hopefully it was a good Christmas period. Watching a lot of cricket with the Boxing Day and Sydney Tests.
That certainly helps. The amount of cricket certainly helps. We had a bit of a delay because my grandmother went into hospital on Christmas Eve, and we sort of got rushed out to the hospital pretty late that night. Things were looking pretty bad. So Christmas
right,
Day, she's on the mend again. Looked pretty scared. It got to the point where it was like... the doctors needed to know whether they were going to resuscitate her or not. So it got pretty
dicey,
serious. Yeah. But she's on the mend. So we sort of, Christmas Day was a complete write-off because my father and his sister had to travel down to Penrith from Lithgow, pick her back up from Nepean Hospital and do all that. So we sort of had a bit of a get-together, a bit of a quieter get-together on Boxing Day,
nice.
Which is normally just want to sit down and watch cricket. But so it was a bit interesting. We sort of watched a bit of cricket, played a bit of cricket, had a bit of fun with it, so as much as you can in that sort of circumstances. But what about yourself? Do you have a good one? You were back in Melbourne?
Yeah, I was back in Melbourne, went to Boxing Day test. Strangely for me, I went on day one. I usually try and do other things on day one, either go shopping or spend some time with some family, friends or whatever, assess how the situation of the game is going and then go day two. But we had a few things to do on day two. So we ended up going day one and, got in a solid 4 hours of cricket before the rain came. So we left the MCG at 3 o'clock, which was a bit of a pain.
I can imagine.
It was a good day of cricket in terms of viewing, though. It was quite a compelling, tight test match.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you certainly... the finish to that test would have certainly made up for any lack of cricket over the few days initially. And I mean, same with everyone. There's nothing worse than rain delays.
Sure.
They sort of bog you down, and it gets really painful and boring. And you get the old highlights on the TV, which for the first 20 minutes is kind of good and nostalgic and interesting. And then you go, I kind of just wish there was live cricket on.
Yeah.
That finish was phenomenal. I mean, we may as well start there. We'll start with the Boxing Day test. We'll cast our minds back. Look, Pakistan.
Feels so long ago.
A bit like that. Yeah. You're not wrong. I'm just sort of looking. It's pretty ridiculous. But, I mean, Pakistan, a good first innings, 443, 9 declared. Azhar Ali, the standout, unbeaten on 205. He put in a strong performance. The Aussies, 8 for 624 in reply. Warner 144, Khawaja 97, Smith unbeaten on 165, and even Stark, who chipped in with 84 off 91 balls.
Seven sixes.
Absolute obliteration. It was great to watch, wasn't it? And Pakistan, the final day, the capitulation, all out for 163, and the Aussies
Aussies
wrapped it up after all that. And again, we spoke about it when England had done it. At that point, it only happened like 3 times in history, and England had done it twice in India. But now we've had 3 in a very short space of time where a team will bat first, score 400-plus, and go on to lose by an innings.
Yeah. I don't know what it says about touring teams' mentality, but it's not a good look to get so despondent after the first innings. Look, obviously conceding 624 can't be fun. Having never been a part of a fielding side that has conceded that many, I can't really say for sure. But surely you know, being professional cricketers, you know, Yunus Khan, Misbah Ul Haq surely would have been able to rally the troops. And they've certainly got enough of an entourage around them of senior pros that they really shouldn't have collapsed in a heap like they did. Like the fact that Azhar Ali scored 245 off his own bat. What's that, 245 on 443 and 160, what's that, 600. So out of 600, he scored 245 of them, so almost half by one batsman. Says that, you know, technically it's possible to make runs out there. It certainly wasn't difficult. And the fact that, you know, Sarfraz Ahmed scored 43 on that fifth day shows that it wasn't demons in the pitch. It was simply, you know, threatening hostile bowling by Lyon and Stark. But I would say also a large part of that was both mental fatigue and an unwillingness to fight. What about you? What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, well, look, I know Pakistan have sort of been on a bit of a high coming in, probably going into New Zealand more than anything, but they've certainly put together some decent results and were trending quite well under Mickey Arthur, but it looks to me almost like all that progress has just been wiped away in two test series. They look fragile. As soon as there was any real pressure applied, there were times when they would fight, but as soon as it became really serious, they crumbled pretty quick. I read a great article on Crick Info. I cannot remember for the life of me who wrote it, but Pakistani origin. But he went on to talk a little bit about the inferiority complex that Pakistan have in the face of Australia, and how they very much look up to Australia and feel overwhelmingly dominated by Australia. And to me, that was very symptomatic in what they put together, particularly at the end of Test matches. So I mean, we've got the big carve up in the Boxing Day test, and again, you know, reasonably similar sort of stuff, if not a little bit more, a little bit easier for the Aussies in the New Year's test as well, which sort of pretty much ended in the same sort of vein. So I don't know. Do you see it a bit like that? Is it a mental fragility thing?
I do think it is. I think it's also, you know how, like, no team has really come to Australia and dominated the way, you know, South Africa have. And I think, that mental fragility comes, you know, with also, you know, playing away from home. Because it is so different for, you know, six of the seven, you know, touring countries when they come to Australia. In terms of cricket conditions, because obviously, you know, living in England or New Zealand or even to an extent South Africa isn't that much different from living in Australia. But in terms of cricket conditions, I think the fact that it's different or actually plays a bigger, you know, has a bigger factor and a bigger influence mentally than the actual physical conditions. You know, I've played cricket on, you know, amateur pitches over in India. And, you know, that was one of the things that some of my cousins were telling me when I was playing with them. It's like, man, it's not that hard. Just don't think it's going to be so hard. You know, just see ball, hit ball, do what you'd always do, and adapt when you need to adapt. You know, don't think there's always going to be spinning. It's always going to be low, slow, whatever. You know, it's really not that much of a change. And something that you see in junior ranks here, when you see, like, you know, a green seeming wicket or a pitch that has a lot of surface cracks on it, you'll see a lot of that, you know, top order batting going, no, win toss bowl. You know, this is going to be horrible to bat on. But then if you lose the toss and you have to bat, the fact that you were thinking that way plays a bigger effect on the outcome of your batting innings. As opposed to if you thought, oh, well, yeah, you know, this will be fun, you know, a bit of a challenge, let's see what happens. I think that the mental attitude of the top order batting is really something that Pakistan and also a lot of the touring sides can work, really need to work on.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, we saw in Sydney, Australia, obviously batting first, eight declared for 538. Big breakthrough moment for Matty Renshaw, 184. David Warner sort of took all the headlines on day one, 100 in the first session, which just ridiculous when you think about it like that.
That was some seriously amazing batting, though. Like,
Oh, yeah.
Like, to think... He didn't take away from it. Like, he didn't...
Go ahead.
He didn't actually take that many risks in terms of, 2020 risks, like, trying to hit it over fielders or, doing, crazy shots. It was just, if it was a decent ball that he could hit it through a gap, he hit it through a gap.
Yeah, well, that's it. He wasn't playing ramp shots or
reverse sweeps
silly cross bat shots or anything like that. He was playing pretty good technical cricket strokes. He was 100 at lunch, and Matty Renshaw was 25.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there were people almost baying for Matty Renshaw's blood. They wanted him to hurry up. Yeah. I'm thinking, why would you... You don't need to hurry up. When you've got David Warner down this end doing that, just sit back and enjoy the show. Whenever you're on strike, hit a single,
I think that...
Get down the other end and let him go.
I think there was an over... I think three or four overs before lunch. I think Warner was on about mid-80s, if I remember correctly. And Renshaw had faced out three dot balls. And the Sydney crowd had just started, booing. And he's, just faced out another three dot balls, made an over, did not have a care in the world. Warner seemed to enjoy the breaker at the non-striker's end. And then next over, he came out and smacked a couple more fours and, worked his way onto his 100. So,
yeah. But I think there was a huge bit of vindication, obviously, throughout the day for Matty, who not only went on to make 100, but went on to be unbeaten at stumps. Was dismissed relatively early on day two, but notched 184, which is just a tremendous score. This kid's 20 years old. You think back to what you were doing at 20 years of age, you weren't scoring massive hundreds at the SCG, at least not without the aid of a computer game. But I know I wasn't anyway. But that was a huge, huge innings. And I think it showed he's got the sort of perseverance and temperament to succeed on the subcontinent as well, which sort of makes it surprising to me that there's question marks that he may or may not actually make the squad for the tour to India. I think that's mind-boggling.
I don't know who started that line of thinking, but I think, and I certainly hope it doesn't happen. Like, I think the top five have to go and have to be backed in for five tests. Unless there is like a huge, injury crisis or, two or three of these guys get multiple ducks in a row.
I agree.
There's no real need for chop and change. And I think the only, potential change I could, foresee would maybe having either a specialist batsman coming in at six, if you keep Wade, or bring Neville back in, bat him at six and have an extra spinner.
There'll be, I think there is room for movement from six down. But I agree wholeheartedly. That top five has got to stay together, barring, as you said, outrageous runs of bad form or injury. The idea should be now to keep them together. I mean, when you look at it, Renshaw is 20, Warner is 30, Khawaja is 30, Smith, I believe, is 27, and Hanscom's similar sort of age,
26.
Yeah, so those guys can be, for the next 5 or 6 years, that can be your top five. And I think that's how Australia got to the position of dominance. There's obviously a lot of factors that got to a position of dominance in the Hayden Langer Ponting days, but that top five can be a long-term solution. And if you're not chopping and changing that, you can focus on getting the other things right, whether that's getting the right all-rounder to fill that sixth batsman slot whether that's getting the right keeper, which I've gone on record and don't think we have at the moment, or whether it's working out which spinners you've got for the conditions. I mean, because feasibly, we could feasibly play three spinners at some point in India, depending on the conditions. I don't think we will. I think it'll probably see the two spinners. I think you'll probably see Lyon and O'Keefe in tandem quite a bit. But feasibly, I mean, Ashton Agar could be an option. Farwan Ahmed could be an option. I mean, even Dutchie Holland could be an option. So I wouldn't rule out the possibility of looking to slot another batsman in somewhere and potentially giving someone like maybe Peter Henscombe the gloves and coming up with another option to get a bowler in there. But the top five has to stay together for mine.
Yeah, 100% agree. I think, you know, Shane Warne was commenting, I think it was either during the test match or when they read out the tweets during the big bash that, you know, they have to take a leg spinner. And, you know, he's obviously championing one of the youngsters, but I do think Farwan Ahmed, I wouldn't say has done, you know, deserves the spot, but certainly has bowled well enough to warrant selection. I don't think anyone in the Shield circuit has really done enough to, you know, deserve that second spinning position per se, but certainly warrants selection in the squad.
Yeah, look, I put together an article today for Real Sport that was my touring squad, and I did overlook Farwan, but I really do get the arguments for him, particularly when you look at the other spinning options being offies, and you look at Ashton Agar and Steve O'Keefe both being left arm orthodox bowlers. If you're looking for variety, and you do need to look for a leg spinner, or they do choose to go down the path of a leg spinner, then I think he's certainly the number one at the top of that list.
I like your list there, especially with the bowlers: Lyon, O'Keefe, Agar, Bird, Sayers, Cummins. That's a lot of bowlers.
Yeah, well, look, I looked at the squad and I sort of thought the same thing. I thought I'd come up with too many bowlers, but by the time I got through the batsmen, which was Warner, Renshaw, Smith, Khawaja, Hanscombe, Maddison, Bancroft and Neville, I thought you don't really need much more than that.
That's true.
And you know what I mean? The only thing I could have done was potentially look at an all-rounder like a Cartwright, a Mitch Marsh, which, heaven help me, or a Moses Enriquez, I guess. But yeah, I'm vehemently anti-Marsh, so I did cop a bit of grief for not picking Sean Marsh from some readers as well, based on his performances in the subcontinent in the past. But you can put my hands down on the top of the stove, and I still wouldn't pick Sean Marsh. So that's just personal.
I probably would have picked Travis Head ahead of Nick Maddison.
Yeah, look, I that was the one I really did toss up, and I nearly picked Head over Bancroft as well, given that Bancroft has been out of form through the Shield. But looking at the development, and I could very easily drop him in for either of those guys. But I'm still a believer in Nick Maddison. I know he's copped a lot of grief, and I know there's sort of a bit of a joke going around about his performances and things like that. But I'm still a believer in. I think he has a future at that level. Yeah. But he could very easily have put Travis Head in there for sure. He's actually on one of my other articles I wrote about up-and-coming stars. I do certainly rate Travis Head as well.
I'd like to see Maddison go and play a county season, actually.
I think that would benefit him greatly. Just reading, I've been reading Chris Rogers' book, which has been phenomenal. I thoroughly recommend anyone who is interested in cricket to pick it up. But anyone who's interested in cricket, as if you'd be listening to this if you weren't. But he talks a lot about how that developed his side of the game, and not just from a technical aspect and from an understanding of different conditions, but it also gave him a greater balance in life as well, going over there, particularly at a young age first, because he was sort of one of those guys that missed the academy. He didn't really get a look in at the academy when that was all coming through. So he sort of really developed as both a person and a cricketer by his experiences over there. So I certainly wouldn't have any grief with guys like Maddison, even Travis Head. I don't know whether he has gone over there in the past or not, but there's certainly plenty to be gained from a season playing county cricket, even just for the amount of cricket they play over there.
Exactly. They play cricket, every third day almost?
Yeah, it's like, I think the county season's like 16 four-day games. Then you've got the, you know, a dozen one-day or 40-over games, whatever they play. And then you've got the T20s as well. There's a lot of cricket that they play over there, which certainly, at the very least, gets you, I think that certainly helps get used to the mental grind, yeah, I guess.
Certainly gets them, increasing their levels of professionalism and the ability to kind of forget about either a poor innings or a great innings. You know, it's always, there's always another game coming pretty quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I think it helps with as well is when you go in as that overseas player, there's a lot of expectation on you. You are the guy that has to, if you're a batsman, you have to score runs. If you're a bowler, you've got to take wickets because you're the guy that's been brought in over the top of a young English player that may have already been there or a veteran that's been holding on to try and get a few more years out of a county career. And it's a big investment because I still believe they can only have the one overseas player and a reserve to replace that person. But so it's a big investment, and someone like a Chris Rogers benefited greatly from that. And he ended up doing a lot of captaining over there as well, and that really grew his appreciation for the game. So I have absolutely no concerns about guys going over and playing county cricket, 100%.
And it'll certainly be a good experience, playing against some of the guys they might face in future Ashes series as well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's no secret that the last Ashes in England, we struggled so greatly with the conditions to the point of almost embarrassment for some guys. It was absolutely pathetic. So any help you can get understanding those conditions, understanding the swing, and understanding the Duke's ball, which is a very different... If you've ever held a Duke's ball, it feels very different to the Kookaburra that we used to. So I certainly, as I said, could not advocate that anymore. And speaking to guys that have come out here, young Sam Billings, that's on the verge of the England squad and playing with the Sixers, he spent some time with the Penrith Cricket Club, a delightful young bloke, and he sort of said the same sort of stuff. He said it was really helping him more off the field than on, but that he was certainly taking in a lot of on-the-field stuff as well. And Penrith's the little cricket club that punches above its weight, so... It's a little plug there for the Summer Panthers, but it's the exact same thing in reverse. So there's plenty to be gained there for sure.
Yep.
Now, in terms of India, if you were to pick a squad straight up, you've seen the squad that I put together. Is there, apart from Travis Head, and Fawad Ahmed, is there anyone else you would consider that should have been in that squad?
Not really, actually. I think, we've pretty much got all the obvious selections in.
The only other one that I tossed up a little bit about, and not for too long because I don't think he's ready on his way back, was probably James Pattinson. He probably hasn't got enough cricket back under the belt, whereas Paddy Cummins is that little bit further ahead.
That's true.
In his return, so that was the other one I weighed up. But while we're looking at squads, we've obviously got a one day series against Pakistan to come up. Now Pakistan have been hit pretty hard. Mohammad Irfan left because his mother has passed away.
Yeah.
So condolences there, and today we find out Sarfraz Ahmed is heading home because his mother's in intensive care in Karachi. So there's some disruptions for the Pakistani side, which will probably hurt them in a pretty big way. But looking at the Australian squad, we've got Smith, Warner, obviously, Cummins, Faulkner, Head, Hazelwood, Khawaja, Lynn, Marsh, Mitchell, Glenn Maxwell, Billy Stanlake, probably the bolter of the squad, Mitch Stark, Matthew Wade, and Adam Zampa. Pretty straightforward from a one-day international perspective.
Yep, very much. Pretty good balance as well there.
Were you surprised with Stanlake?
Not really. I think he's done enough, especially in the Big Bash, to show that he's in good form. He bowls pretty consistently tight overs. I think it was Mark Waugh yesterday who was pointing to Cummins saying, look, he always has that one over where he goes for more than 15.
Yeah.
Whereas Stan Lake, I think, has done, you know, enough to warrant selection in being, you know, the consistent bowler. Like, you know, obviously we're not expecting him to bowl as quick as Cummins or Stark or be as, you know, consistent and threatening as Hazelwood. But he's got that in-between middle ground down pat really well, where I suppose it was, you know, kind of that last occupied by, like, the likes of Siddle, where he'll, you know, consistently bowl six good balls, of which maybe two might actually get a wicket. But he doesn't have that one bad ball and over that, you know, good batsman put away.
Yeah, look, I think that's probably a pretty fair assessment. The guys that missed out, the guys that were dropped from the last squad, George Bailey and Aaron Finch, and
I think
probably some other guys on the fringe as well. Like, I thought there's a few guys that have been around a little while that come in and out of these one-day squads, but I was happy to see Chris Lynn get a nod.
Yeah, me too. I think we said it in our probably first or second pod. We spoke that, you know, if Finch didn't make some runs against the Kiwis, he might be out. And he didn't make runs against the Kiwis, and he's out. So
yeah. Yeah, sums it up pretty well.
I think we picked the selector's logic there, so
yeah, Bailey was an interesting one for me. He's had his last five or six performances have been pretty average for Australia, but beyond that, he's been a pretty consistent performer with the bat. And more than that, I think he's a really good presence around a squad that is starting to bring some young guys through. So I was a little bit surprised to see Bailey get moved on. But, I mean, there's obviously only so much room. Mm. And with someone like Chris Lynn, you couldn't say no.
Yeah.
Based on his, I mean, 98, 84 and 85 in the Big Bash this year. I think the 98, in fact, they were all unbeaten. So he's not some big scores. He's been completely devastating with the bat. So you really have to reward someone like that at this point.
And also he scored 23-0, not out, and 17 against the Kiwis. So, you know, I think between form and generational change, he's kind of copped it, which is...
And I mean, he's only 26, 27, so he's not... Oh, sorry, this is Lynn I'm talking about. He's only 26, 27, so he's at a good age where he's got plenty of domestic cricket under his belt, and I don't think he'd be too ruffled by playing international cricket.
And he certainly played some international cricket before as well, so let me just pull up his record there.
Better say, has he? I'm not sure if he has actually played international cricket.
I think he got picked for last year's T20.
Let's say, if he has played international, it will only be the T20. Yeah. I don't think he's played any one-day internationals, has he?
No.
T20 international. Yeah, he has played. He has played some T20 internationals. Yeah. So, he has. He has made that, but it's obviously another step to play.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
To play one-day domestic cricket, the 50-over format, but five one-day, five T20s he's played for Australia. So a little bit of experience
and
there.
And I think he was also, this, you know, kind of, you know, I think this summer was that, you know, getting him integrated into the squad, because he did play all four of the Australia A games in August. And he did, you know, relatively well in those. So I think he's one of the players that I think has been identified a couple of years ago, you know, to slowly integrate into that ODI T20 international setup. So
yeah, look, I think that's a fair point. It's probably on that. It's probably worth segueing slightly into the Big Bash.
Yep.
I know you'll be wanting to avoid it, but we'll jump straight to the main point. The Stars surrendered the first win of the tournament to the Sydney Thunder. The Stars surrendering the the first win of the tournament for the Sydney Thunder. Owen Morgan, the six off the last ball. T20 cricket doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. Especially when the Stars, you know, beat... can't remember who we beat last night. We beat someone. It was good. It was a good game. Hilfie pulled it out of the fire. So he's gone from, you know, villain to hero in the space of 3 days. So, you know, Melbourne love him again.
It's the great thing about the BBL, though, isn't it? Because there is just games coming and coming and coming. Yeah. So you can literally, as you said, you can redeem yourself inside 24 to 48 hours. And, I mean, I actually got a soft spot for Hilfie. I think Ben's a terrific bloke. And the look on his, when you see the angle from behind the umpire when Morgan hit the six, and both of them immediately knew.
Yeah.
Batsman and bowler both knew it was a six. The head went down. Morgan's jumped up. It was phenomenal. It made me quite happy that I had decided to stay on the lounge and continue to read my book rather than go to bed, as I really wanted to do. Yeah. I was sort of like, oh, not again, come on. But two wins for the Thunder now, so I'm back enjoying the BBL, and I'm calling it an undefeated run of the table to win the tournament now, a la Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers. I'm calling the run now. But it's been thoroughly enjoyable.
Yeah. I think Hilfenhaus, if I remember correctly, it's not the first time he's been hit for six off the last ball to lose a game.
Probably not. Yeah. Probably not.
I remember him doing it once last year for the Stars, and I think, if I remember correctly, I think it was a four off the last ball when he was playing for the Hurricanes.
So there is
a bit of a pressure question about Hilfenhaus bowling that last over. But what do you think of this whole the phenomenon of losing players to the national side?
It's the timing is awful. Yeah.
You're being penalised for being good.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that has happened since day one. Day one, the Thunder lost David Warner and Michael Clarke. Michael Clarke was only ever going to play one game, and he pulled out of that with a back injury.
Yeah.
And that destroyed them, and we all know how the Thunder were across the first four seasons of the competition. Completely pathetic in most anything else. It's impossible to get any rhythm, and as you said, you do get punished for having players who are good enough to make international squads. The problem being, Cricket Australia are always going to want to play the big bash over this Christmas New Year period when there's Christmas school holidays and people away from work so that they can maximise crowds. And wherever they're going to do that, it's going to clash with international cricket because there's going to be test matches. They're going to go straight into one dayers because the calendar is so jam-packed as it is.
Yeah.
They're just trying to wedge things in as best they can.
I'm just thinking, if you had like a Jose Mourinho or Sir Alex Ferguson kind of character, you know, being the coach or the manager of the Melbourne Stars team, I think from probably the 1st of Jan, Glenn Maxwell and James Faulkner would have been injured. Just to make sure that we had them for the finals.
It's one of those things that's hard to convey in a podcast, but they would be injured.
Yes, and unavailable for selection.
And then miraculous recoveries just in time. Yeah, look, it certainly would be. The problem is, particularly with the analogy of football and cricket, football is very much club-focused. The focus is on the clubs far more than it is on the countries outside sort of World Cups and national
international tournaments,
confederate championships. Cricket is obviously far more a game based around the international game, particularly, and I know the BBL sort of pushes those domestic figures up, but anyone who's ever been to a Sheffield Shield game and then a test match can certainly attest to where the interest lies, because the last time I went to a Sheffield Shield game, I think there was myself and about 14 other people.
Yep.
And which is ridiculous considering how high a quality the cricket is, but it's certainly not a huge attraction, domestic cricket in a draw sense, and anyone who's going to be in that fold for Australia is is obviously going to be far more focused on playing for Australia or another country than their BBL franchise.
Of course, yeah.
It's going to be one of those things. You just got to deal with it,
yeah,
I suppose.
Yeah, the last time I went to a Sheffield Shield game, I think it was Vicks versus South Australia. And I got in for free because I was wearing my club cricket hat, sat in the members because there was no one else there and they only had the members open. Ended up talking to the players because they were, you know, wanting some sunshine, so they came out and sat in the, you know, in the normal seats.
Yep.
And then when I was can't remember who I was talking to, said, you know, and I said, oh, sorry guys, I have to go to the toilet. They're like, oh, no, just go up and use ours. So, you know, there are literally about 30 people in the MCG, including the 22, you know, players. So, yeah, obviously, you know, the money and all the power and the control comes from, you know, the international game, and that's fine, fair enough. But I do think that might be one area where things, you know, slowly change over time and it becomes more club-based.
I certainly hope so. I mean, as I said, the last game I went to, I'm pretty sure there was myself and about 14 other people, and there was myself and a friend in the bay, and there was only one other person in the whole bay worth of seats, which was great seats right around next to the members at the Sydney Cricket Ground. And there was one other guy there, and it was an older guy who, I kid you not, for the entire day, read the newspaper. Did not put it down. Didn't move, didn't get up, didn't go to the toilet or anything. He sat there from first ball to the end of the day and read his newspaper.
He's probably one of the dads of the players came to see his son bat, and they're probably in the field. Yeah. So he's like, "Nah, can't be bothered paying attention."
Whatever. Yeah, it almost had to have been because he did not bat. He would not have seen more than an over's worth of balls in an entire day. It was just like, okay, this guy is not here because he really wants to be. And I mean, you'll always get that like three or four old guys that go down with scorebooks and fastidiously take score of the day, and I could not think of a worse way to spend a day. I've done scoring for club cricket. It's painful. Let's not beat around the bush. I don't mind doing it to help out, but it's certainly not what I'd be doing if I had a choice.
Yeah.
But there's always that one guy there with a scorebook. It's like, what do you do with it when you get home?
Yeah.
Just have lots of scorebooks around that. I mean, I can just Google it and have the exact same information in 2 seconds, but no, that's fair. Now, he's probably done it for 100 years, and credit to him, I suppose. But yeah, I don't know. I could not have sounded more dismissive of that guy there, but I didn't mean to be that horrible.
I think Chris Rogers has said something very similar on national radio, so I think you're safe.
I'm guided by him. More so now because he has liked a couple of my tweets and responded to a couple of my tweets. So
painful.
I'm in the early stages of what I hope is a burgeoning bromance with Chris Rogers. I put a tweet out. I didn't even tag him in it. It was something like, I think Matt Renshaw is slowly replacing Chris Rogers as my current man crush. Yeah. And spam, like from Chris Rogers. And I was just like, oh, this is awkward. But also amazing. He kind of knows that I exist on Twitter, so that's pretty cool. Mind you, you're like this. I put on Twitter, right? Didn't tag anyone, didn't sort of put it out in there. When watching the Thunder versus the Stars, Sam Harper was carrying on a bit behind the wicket, a lot of noise, a lot of carry on, and I tweeted, I think Sam Harper might be the biggest bell end in the BBL.
Oh,
clearly one of his friends has seen it.
Yeah.
And asked me, like, have you ever had a conversation with him? And I'm like, no, this is far more than I need to hear of Sam Harper. And then, like, 2 days later, I get a notification. Sam Harper likes your tweet. I was like, oh, how good is that? This guy, well, at least he knows. I think he sounded like a bell end. But I'm like, I'm not going to change my opinion, man. You were carrying on like a pork chop, but...
talking about wicketkeepers and the weird carry-on, what do you make of... what's his name for the Hurricanes? Tim Payne. Like, half appealing.
Oh, he's just as painful.
It's like, dude, if you think it's out, appeal properly.
Yeah, and I get it. You sort of have that little bit of, oh, I've got energy, I'm bouncing around. But there's like a limit, dude. And I mean, if I was the umpire, I'd almost walk up and say, fair dinkum, stuff it, or there's going to be something further out of it. Because it does get awfully annoying, particularly with all the stump microphones that you have now and things like that. The only other thing that really annoyed me, I listened to one of the BBL games the other day on the radio, and it's only on Macquarie. I normally listen to ABC Grandstand if I listen to the radio, but it was on the Macquarie network. And I don't think it's possible for them to have squeezed any more sponsorship pieces into one piece of commentary. I don't know if you've listened to them, but it's like
SEN
the
used to
Company
do the
A.
Same thing,
Oh, it's painful. Company A shot of the day for every second shot on the Company B scoreboard, brought to you by Company C and Company D in conjunction with Company E, F, and G. And you're like,
yeah. By the time they actually
I get
end
it.
Up
the sponsors,
the ads, they're about two balls behind.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm just like, oh, God, this is why I don't listen to Macquarie Network Cricket. So thank God the ABC is still around and still rolling strong. Mm. Look, have you had a chance? I know you've put it on the running order. Have you had a chance to watch any more women's Big Bash over the last few weeks?
Not a lot, actually. I think the timings of some of these games are really annoying.
It's not
ideal.
Consumer-friendly.
Like, obviously, you know, you can't run them back-to-back because both the ground needs a rest and, you know, it's not really doable for the television. But, you know, games that start at 2 o'clock in the afternoon or even sometimes, like, at 10 o'clock in the morning and finish by 1, you're like, dude, you know, people have got things to do. I haven't had a chance to physically watch a lot of the games, but certainly some of the scores and some of the highlights have been absolutely amazing. Like, if we have any listeners who are cricket coaches, find the highlights of Alyssa Healy's wicket-keeping. Some of her stumpings are absolutely world-class. I would say she's got faster hands than MS Dhoni, and Dhoni was probably the best wicketkeeper in the men's game for about 5 or 6 years, you know, without peer. And I think Healy has really taken wicketkeeping in the women's game to another level. And probably she's probably the best wicketkeeper in the country, you know, regardless of gender.
It might be worth putting a fake mustache on her ahead of the India tour, maybe.
Yeah, you know, just slide her in into the side, batter it. She could probably hold her own batting at 7 as well. So certainly do a better job than Wagyu, but
the bar hasn't been set super high at the moment. So let's be honest. But one thing I also did want to talk about, there's been a suggestion, a little bit of conflict of interest with the BBL commentary. So you've obviously got Ricky Ponting now coming in as a T20 coach, Mark Waugh. He's obviously a selector. These guys are on a lot of cricket. They're putting their opinions out there a lot. Is there a real conflict of interest there?
I think there is. I think they should be more, like, aware of it. I suppose, you know, Mark Waugh doesn't respond when they say, oh, who are you picking next week? You know, he laughs that kind of stuff off, but, you know, he's not averse to giving a forthright opinion on where he thinks a batsman or a bowler is in terms of, you know, the general, you know, frame, or, you know, whether they're in the race to get picked. And I think those kind of things is really good for us as, you know, the viewing public to go, oh, yeah, he's thinking about this guy. But whether or not that's, you know, good for his job as a selector, I don't think, you know, I don't think it works. I don't think you could have a selector who can say on one BBL, and he's going, oh, yeah, I'm keeping an eye on him, and, you know, he's close to the picture, and then have 2 weeks later go, oh, mate, you haven't done enough, when you're actually talking to the player. Because obviously, you know, the people around said player is going to go, you know, send that player messages, oh, Mark Waugh thinks you're, you know, close to the 11 or close to the squad or something. I think it puts him in a really awkward position. Something that we've seen, you know, being addressed almost head on. You know, Gary Neville being a pundit and a team coach over in England, and I think Ponting is in a very similar position. You know, having to comment and critique players who he's soon going to be coaching, and I don't think it's an easy fence to straddle.
I agree with you wholeheartedly on Ponting and coaching. Obviously, you're sort of in that inner sanctum, and you, more than anything, you really need the trust of the players. I think with someone like War or any selector, I think a lot of it comes down to what the level of communication is behind the scenes, whether he's having conversations with a batsman or a bowler or anyone, and being open and forthright prior to what gets said on television. So whether he says to Chris Lynn, look, yeah, we really want to pencil you in for the one day series, and then when it comes out on national television and he says, yeah, look, we're going to put Chris Lynn in the ODI team, that's fine. To me, that's fine. The player knows where he stands. That's just been confirmed publicly, and whether you want to confirm it publicly, I suppose, is a matter for the selectors. But I think if there is a really good and open dialogue between selectors and players, which I'm not sure that there is, then it's fine. But if there's not, and you've got players who, and I'm led to believe this is the case, you've got players who maybe aren't 100% sure of what their role is or where they fit in the scheme of things, and you look at guys at the moment like an Aaron Finch or a George Bailey, particularly Bailey, he's what, 34, 35? Mm. He's got to be at a point where he's wondering whether he's going to play international cricket again. And if Mark Waugh gets asked that question on the next BBL game and he goes, oh, look, we feel that he may have a spot. He says, gives a diplomatic answer if he goes back and scores runs, et cetera, et cetera. But then he turns around and says to George Bailey, we're not going to pick you again. That to me is the concern, because that gives someone like George Bailey, and I'm not saying George would be this guy. I honestly don't think he would, but I think he's the best example right now. He can go away with a genuine axe to grind and say, well, look, the public image is go away and score runs and I'll get back in the side. I've gone away, I've scored runs, but what's the point? Because Mark Waugh's already told me, or Rod Marsh, or whoever's already told me, Trevor Holmes has told me, I'm not going to be in the squad. Yeah. So what's the point?
Yeah.
I think a big concern.
That a very similar kind of scenario almost came to a head when they were talking to Brad Hodge. I think it was Damien Fleming that asked him, I think he was at the time like number two or three in the run scoring, huge strike rate, looked like the best Australian T20 batsman, before Lynn and Pearson caught fire. And he asked, are you available for national selection? Ponting had a chuckle. Mark Waugh was, tight-lipped, nothing, didn't say anything. And Brad Hodge had to almost, excuse himself by saying, oh, no, man, I think international cricket's past me. Whereas I think if that question was, directed at Mark Waugh, the response would have been interesting. And I think it's another thing that might happen, if Cameron White scores 100 off of, 65 balls or something in the 2020, he's up there leading the run scoring charts for Victoria. He's up there in two formats of the game, and he's doing well. If he's doing well personally for the Renegades, why isn't he in the picture, is there like a certain age cutoff that the sporting public doesn't really know about?
I suppose it's a genuine question. And as I said, it probably comes down to transparency more than anything. And as much as we all want to know, we don't really have a right or even a need to know who's going to be in a squad before it's announced or who's in calculations. It really comes down to having trust in the process and trusting that the selectors are looking at all their options and trusting that if a player performs, then they're going to put themselves in a position to get selected. And as we've seen in the past, that's not always going to be the case. Chris Rogers is another one. In his book, he speaks about that. He was told go back and score runs, and he spent a period where over 3 years he was the highest net run scorer in domestic cricket worldwide. And he said, I felt like I could not have been further away from the national setup, despite scoring runs. And it sort of wasn't until a couple of years later that he got back into the side. So I suppose it's a tough one. It's probably tougher on players than it is on us, because we can sort of take that fluff answer and go away and write a piece saying that George Bailey is in contention.
Yeah.
Whether he is or not. But for him, it's obviously going to be a much more impactful thing.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, going back to that issue of, you know, how much transparency is enough or is warranted, you know, obviously you're right when you say, you know, we don't have a right to know. But Channel 10, by employing these guys as, you know, commentators and you know, special comments guys, it has almost opened up that, you know, Pandora's box of how selections actually work. And so, you know, a little bit of information is a, you know, dangerous thing, right? So if we go, you know, yeah, if Mark Waugh, you know, and having them do this, you know, top 10 players or top 10 batsmen, top 10 bowlers, blah, 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 you know, of the Big Bash so far, as Ricky Ponting always loves to, you know, point out so far. I think it does almost question the method and the process, not necessarily the outcome, because we always judge the outcome, you know, of the process, as in, so, you know, here's the 15 or the 13-man squad. We're like, okay, yeah, fine. Let's see how they perform, and then we'll judge the selection. But now that we're seeing the process of how they're actually selecting them, we're going to start judging the process as well by going, okay, well, if you told us, you know, here were your top 10 BBL batsmen, well, why haven't you just picked the top 5 or 6 that are Aussies for the ODI side, right? Like, you know, how do they justify having, you know, Warner, Khawaja and Steve Smith, who haven't played a T20 game potentially since, you know, September or even before that? How can we go, oh, well, you know, they're the 3 best batsmen in the country, and therefore they'll fit into a, you know, into our T20 side. You know, that next level of questioning is what Channel 10 have kind of, you know, pushed us towards. And I think unless they actually want to answer those kind of, you know, difficult questions, you know, as I said, a little bit of information can be a bit dangerous.
I think I do agree wholeheartedly, and I think it can also work in reverse as well, in that if you've got questions being asked of selectors, say, use Mark Waugh as the example, and they say, is such and such in contention? And he says, yes. Because 9 times out of 10, they'll say, look, we'll look at anyone. Yeah. If they're performing, we'll pick them, blah, blah, blah. And they say that, and then they don't get picked for the next squad or the squad after or the squad after. You get to the point where, what's the point of saying anything? Because we don't believe you.
Of course, yeah.
I don't believe that you're looking at this player, because despite the fact that you keep telling me that you are, he's consistently overlooked despite performances. So I think it can work in that way as well. But as you said, more than anything, it's a Pandora's box. And it's sort of one that I don't think will be closed anytime soon, because Channel 10 have obviously got their focus on getting that star power in to head the coverage and to put that colour commentary into perspective. And, you know, it's. I certainly don't think they're going to change that approach anytime soon.
Yeah, certainly not. I think it'll be interesting, like, if they were to, you know, if Cricket Australia were to say to Mark, well, look, you either pick us or, you know, pick Channel 10. It'll be very interesting to see, you know, if he chooses to still be a selector and a media figure, or if he, you know, picks one or the other. Because it's something that we haven't seen in the past. Like, we never had, you know, Greg Chappell, Trevor Holmes, Inverarity, or, you know, Buchanan, or any of those previous guys, whether it be coaching or selectors, you know, have to, I wouldn't say, yeah, almost, you know, give off-the-cuff responses. Like, if he, you know, came in saying, okay, these are the 15 guys I'm willing to talk about in terms of national selection, and then, you know, just gave a blank face to everything else, but obviously not be as good for us watching the Big Bash, but it would certainly, you know, be perfectly understandable as part of his remit as a selector. So it's a very yeah. fine line. And I think it's something, you know, that we're seeing today with Darren Lehman. You know, he has to be, it's almost like a, you know, a 3 hour question time, like the politician's face.
Yeah. Look, speaking from personal experience, all you want to do is rock up to the Customs House Hotel during a test match in Hobart when Greg Chappell, Ian Healy and Tim Nielsen are half pissed. Oh. Because trust me, you hear some interesting things. And certainly stuff that you wouldn't hear on the television.
Yeah.
Including Greg Chappell loves the C word. I'm just going to throw that out there. Loves it. Big Cricket? Fan. Yeah, we'll go with that. We'll go with that. whatever helps you sleep at night. Yeah, cricket, yeah.
Cricket and
catching. Cricket and yeah. catches. He was a lot of. All he did was speak in slogans, like catches win matches, yeah. over and over again. Yeah, no, I'll tell you off air because he was a very interesting gentleman. but look, that'll probably just about do us for episode 6. We've just coming up on the hour mark now, so we might look at wrapping everything up. Is there anything you'd like to drop out before we go?
No, just enjoy the summer, stay cool, and enjoy the Big Bash. And
absolutely.
What day is when they start? When do they start?
Friday, I believe.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, they're like just around the corner, so it's like not far away at all.
You can tell I don't plan ahead in terms of cricket watching. I just come home and, you know, turn on Channel 9 yeah. or Channel 10, see where the game's on, and, you know, watch it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I'm mostly the same. I just remember looking at some. Well, I've got one of my guys, because I've just taken up the editor's role with Real Sport, and one of the guys wanted to do a story about scheduling. So I remember. So, quick plug, realsport101.com. cricket editor Daniel Lang, the man with the man, the legend, the mythos. good Lord, what's the world coming to? So I do remember him mentioning something about the fixture congestion. So back of my head says Friday. Don't quote me on it. Check cricket.com.au
yeah.
or check realsport101.com and have a look at the article. I'm sure the schedule will be in there. So look, guys, as Vish said, enjoy your weekend, enjoy your cricket. We'll be back next week to keep on keeping on and this,
keeping you entertained,
this little podcast.
Yeah,
yeah, well, over 900 downloads on the last episode, so thank you so much for that. We'll continue to do what we can do to get past the 1,000 mark, first of all. 1,000 downloads in a calendar year sort of thing. We'll look at that and see if we can get ourselves up there with
sure,
the greats.
Sure, and if anyone has any questions or anything they'd like our opinions on, feel free to leave a message on our Facebook page.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or hit us up directly on Twitter.
By all means, yeah, you are at...
United_journal.
Excellent. I'm at undiluted7. Please don't hesitate. Love having a chat and love talking cricket. So please don't hesitate, guys. Have a lovely weekend. We'll talk soon. Bye. This podcast proudly recorded and produced by Strawberry Podcast Solutions.